Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the May 17th, 2024 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Joe Biden standing on, it looks like he might be on the mall out in front of the Capitol building. He's in the foreground. He's got his hand on his forehead with a what am I going to do look. To his back and left are pro-Palestinian protesters, signs, screaming, and they're yelling at the people back on his right, which are pro-Israel protesters, most of them young people, but just hundreds of people on either side of him. The headline is Protest Vote. Will the chaos on campus hurt Biden in November? And that is our controversy of the week. I think we'll actually read both of the main stories this morning, starting with defying U.S., Israel edges closer to Rafah invasion. What happened? Israel launched a limited military operation in the southern Gazan city of Rafah this week and signaled that a larger offensive may be imminent, even as the U.S. expressed optimism that a ceasefire deal could be struck at Israel-Hamas talks in Cairo. The Israel Defense Forces issued evacuation orders to 100,000 civilians in Rafah, Hamas' last remaining stronghold in the Palestinian territory, before launching airstrikes and seizing control of the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. Hamas, which days earlier had killed four Israeli soldiers in a rocket attack, announced it had accepted a ceasefire deal proposed by Arab mediators. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu dismissed the terms accepted by the Palestinian terrorist group as very far from Israel's core demands. Still, a White House spokesman said the ongoing ceasefire negotiations in Egypt were promising and that the U.S. saw no reason Israel and Hamas couldn't bridge their differences. The U.S. and other allies have for months warned Israel not to invade Rafah, which is packed with more than 1 million Palestinians, many displaced from elsewhere in war-torn Gaza, saying an assault could result in massive civilian casualties. The city is also a crucial transit hub for relief efforts in Gaza, parts of which are now experiencing full-blown famine after 7 months of war, said Cindy McCain, director of the UN World Food Program. Aid officials said that Israel's evacuation order directed civilians to a humanitarian zone that is unsafe and unprepared to accommodate them. There are no safe zones in Gaza, said top European Union diplomat Josep Borrell. The Biden administration confirmed a report it had withheld a shipment of 3,500 bombs slated for Israel for fear they would be used in Rafah, a sign of growing tensions over Israel's conduct in a war that, according to Hamas-run health authorities, has killed more than 34,000 Palestinians. Biden has warned Netanyahu not to attack Rafah without a credible plan to protect civilians, and he reiterated that warning in a call this week, the White House said. In a defiant speech on Holocaust Remembrance Day, Netanyahu rejected international pressure, declaring, "If Israel is forced to stand alone, Israel will stand alone," what the editorial said. An Israeli offensive against Rafah should be unthinkable, said the Guardian. It would worsen a dire humanitarian disaster and add to the colossal civilian death toll. There are an estimated 600,000 children in Rafah, and telling them to evacuate is useless when there is nowhere safe to go. While negotiations continue, the imperatives are unchanged: an immediate ceasefire, the release of Hamas more than 100 Israeli hostages, and an increase in humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. The cost of failure grows every day. Israel must take Rafah, said the Wall Street Journal, and Biden must support our ally. When Hamas slaughtered 1,200 Israelis on October 7th, it became impossible for Israel to allow Hamas to control territory and remain in power. Hamas has dragged out ceasefire negotiations in bad faith, as Biden and other leaders have warned Israel not to attack Rafah, which hosts the terrorist group leaders and four battalions of its fighters. Leaving Hamas in peace to plan the next massacre is not an option. What the columnist said: the Israeli and Hamas proposals being hashed out in Cairo are broadly similar, said the economist. Both call for a ceasefire that would unfold in three stages, beginning with the freeing of 33 Israeli hostages, including women, minors, and the elderly, in return for the release of hundreds of Palestinians jailed in Israel. The key sticking point comes in stage two, which calls for both sides to work toward a sustainable calm in Gaza. Hamas wants that to mean a permanent ceasefire, while Israel is only willing to accept a temporary one. It's not clear whether either side actually wants a deal, said Peter Baker in the New York Times. Some veteran observers of the Middle East believe Hamas is willing to endure an assault on Rafah because outrage over the ensuing carnage would isolate Israel globally and deepen the U.S.-Israel divide. For his part, Netanyahu faces intense pressure to invade Rafah from far-right members of his cabinet, whom he needs to remain in power. If Biden won't deliver the munitions he's withholding, then Congress must force his hand, said Richard Goldberg in the New York Post. Facing an existential threat, Israel must finish the job it started. But to help his reelection bid, Biden is threatening to hamstring our ally to appease his party's pro-Hamas contingent. Actually, it's time for Biden to use the leverage he's got, said Andreas Kluth in Bloomberg. Netanyahu has repeatedly ignored his request to moderate Israel's warfighting tactics, but merely hinting at a suspension of weapon shipments could change Bibi's tune. We should be under no illusions about how momentous an assault on Rafah would be, said Daniel DePetris in the Chicago Tribune. An assault would yield a humanitarian calamity. The diplomatic consequences would be no less explosive. The truce talks would be ripped apart. Global blowback would be fierce, and U.S.-Israel relations would be dangerously strained. Netanyahu knows this, but appears determined to go in anyway. It's hard to overstate just how dangerous this entire situation is. And our second main story: Stormy Daniels details sexual encounter with Trump. What happened? Donald Trump's hush money trial took a lurid turn this week with the testimony of porn actress Stormy Daniels, while his repeated violations of a gag order threatened to land the former president in jail. Daniels testified that she and Trump met at a Lake Tahoe golf championship in 2006, and Trump invited her to dinner. She said she didn't expect to meet with him in his hotel room, nor for him to be partly undressed, to compare her to his daughter Ivanka, or to mention that he no longer shared a bedroom with his wife. At first, she said, the two discussed the business aspects of the porn industry and his ability to get her a TV job. But then Trump demanded sex, and she eventually acquiesced. She said she felt an imbalance of power because he was bigger and blocking the way out. Her graphic testimony, in which she described details of their condom-free encounter, visibly disturbed some jurors. In a heated exchange during cross-examination, defense lawyer Susan Nichols sought to portray Daniels as seeking both profit and revenge on Trump after losing a 2018 defamation suit against him. The defense team requested a mistrial, with defense attorney Todd Blanche calling Daniel's insinuation of coercion extraordinarily prejudicial. Judge Juan Merchan agreed that some things would probably have been better left unsaid, but dismissed the mistrial motion, saying the defense could have objected more frequently. In a separate case, Merchan levied his 10th $1,000 fine against Trump for violating a gag order against publicly criticizing trial participants. The $1,000 fines are not serving as a deterrent, Merchan said. Going forward, this court will have to consider a jail sanction. What the columnist said. Daniel's testimony paints a picture of a man dripping with sexual entitlement, said David Graham in The Atlantic. The married 60-year-old Trump's initial curiosity about her job gave Daniels, then 27, the mistaken impression their dinner date was intended for either socializing or business. But Trump apparently saw her, as he saw so many other women, as only as a vehicle to sex. This case, remember, was meant to be about the falsification of business records and vaguely defined election fraud, said Freddie Gray in The Spectator. There's zero need for jurors to know what Trump was wearing or whether they had sex at all. But Daniel's account brings up things that hurt Trump with women voters. And that's the point of this political hit job. Shame on Merchan for allowing it, said Jonathan Turley in the New York Post. It's his job to keep the trial from devolving into sleazy tabloid spectacle. Yet this testimony was entirely sensational and gratuitous. Most maddening was that he blamed Trump's team for not objecting more. Yet Daniel's court appearance ultimately checked important boxes for both sides, said Norman Eisen in CNN.com. The level of detail she offered underscored that Trump had a powerful motive for paying her off to save himself politically. The defense's strong cross-examination, meanwhile, was able to establish Daniel's personal grudge against Trump, as well as some inconsistencies in her past statements. In any case, Daniel's testimony is not nearly as significant as that of earlier witnesses, said Jonathan Alter in the New York Times. Before she took the stand, several gray-haired bean counters from the Trump Organization described how $130,000 purportedly paid to Daniels was recorded as a business expense to disguise its true purpose. Former White House official Hope Hicks, a Trump loyalist who cried on the stand because she didn't want to hurt her mentor, nevertheless testified that he knew the money was intended to silence Daniels. The prosecution hasn't yet called fixer Michael Cohen, the person who made the payment, but already its mountain of evidence is piled as high as Trump Tower. That might not matter, said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Trump won't stop making menacing comments about trial participants, and that puts Merchan in a bind. Ignoring them or levying more small fines risks making a mockery of his gag order. But ordering jail time would make Trump a martyr. A hung jury is not a remote prospect, and even a conviction might only bolster Trump's claims of victimhood with voters. He did, after all, use his Georgia mugshot as a fundraising tool, and he's raising more money off the New York case. Trump has a unique talent for benefiting from circumstances that would doom an ordinary politician. And the controversy of the week, campus protests, a threat to Biden's reelection bid. The keffiyeh-draped young protesters on American college campuses may not save a single life in Gaza, said Jonathan V. Last in The Bulwark, but they're making a valuable in-kind contribution to the campaign of Donald Trump. Going back to 1968, when anti-Vietnam War protests helped drive voters into the arms of Richard Nixon, Civil unrest has always boosted Republican presidential candidates, and Trump, pitching himself as the law and order candidate, has seen a 1 to 2 percentage point bounce in the polls since students began setting up pro-Palestinian encampments. With protesters now clashing with police and pro-Israel demonstrators, the echoes of 1968 are getting louder, said Joey Garrison in USA Today, and it's put President Joe Biden in a no-win situation. In a carefully worded speech this week, Biden decried the ferocious surge in anti-Semitism globally and said there is no place on any campus in America for hate speech or threats of violence. But he stopped short of denouncing the protest against Israel's war in Gaza, presumably for fear of alienating young voters and progressives he desperately needs in November. That reticence risks alienating moderates, while also feeding new lines of attack to Trump and Republicans. This isn't 1968, said Serene Habishian in Axios. The protests that year were nationwide against a U.S.-led war in which young Americans were fighting and dying. This year's protests, although they are dominating headlines, involve only a sliver of students at a handful of elite colleges. Indeed, in a new national poll, college students rank Gaza last in matters of importance to them, 9th out of 9 issues, behind health care reform and economic fairness. Trump tried smearing Biden as the candidate of social disorder in 2020 after the George Floyd riot, said James Politi in Financial Times. That effort wasn't particularly effective back then, and it's unlikely to work now for a candidate accused of multiple felonies. It's true that the fanatics chanting pro-Hamas slogans in solidarity encampments are relatively few in number, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter, but that just makes it all the more pathetic that Biden won't take them on. Look, I'm deeply sympathetic to the argument that Israel overreached, overbombed, and overreacted after the October 7th massacre. Yet the campus protesters aren't calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, but intifada revolution in America and the destruction of Israel. Biden, not Trump, is 2024's chaos candidate, said Matthew Continetti in National Review. From the Afghanistan withdrawal to the border to college campuses, Biden has given us 4 years of turmoil with passivity, denial, and spin instead of leadership. He can reverse the chaos narrative, said A.B. Stoddard in The Bulwark. Biden needs to start denouncing anti-Israel protests as loudly and passionately as he denounced the 2017 neo-Nazi protests in Virginia. Yes, this might alienate some young voters, but the kids don't vote much anyway. What he can't do is lose the middle, the millions of Americans still waiting for the normalcy Biden promised 4 years ago. Much will depend on the protests, said Gabriel DeBenedetti in New York Magazine. They could fade as students go home for the summer, or if war ends in Gaza. But it's also possible the protests could spread and intensify. You don't have to look back to 1968 to know how much can change in the final 6 months of an election. And here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for vindication. After the parents of a North Carolina toddler who had complained of a monster in her bedroom wall discovered a terrifying colony of 50,000 bees behind the drywall. Mother Ashley Macy's class said that when a beekeeper smashed a hole in the wall, the insects came swarming out like a horror movie. It was a good week for carnivores after McDonald's CFO Ian Borden announced that the chain is creating a larger, satiating burger, possibly heftier than the four-patty double Big Mac, to build on our leadership in beef. It was a good week for arts and crafts. After a Florida couple tried to redeem a winning $1 million lottery ticket they'd taped together from sections of two losing tickets. While the pair now face criminal charges, the police report does note that the fake ticket was carefully pieced together. But it was a bad week for canines after South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem suggested President Biden's dog Commander should suffer the same fate as her disobedient puppy Cricket, which she describes shooting dead in a new memoir. Biden's dog has attacked 24 Secret Service people, she said on CBS's Face the Nation. How many is enough before you make a decision on a dog? It was a bad week for intimacy after the head of Michigan's Agriculture Department, responding to the spread of bird flu among cattle, signed an order imposing restrictions on human-cow contact at state farms. Now is not a good time to cuddle cows, said Tim Boring. Finally, it was a bad week for hydration after Esteban Prado, winner of California's Orange County Marathon, was disqualified for taking a cup of water from his dad mid-race, which officials deemed unauthorized assistance. The briefing this week is titled America's Organ Failure. Thousands of patients die each year while waiting for an organ transplant, and not just because of a donor shortage. How many people need transplants? About 104,000 Americans are on the organ transplant wait list. While a record 46,632 transplants were performed in the U.S. last year, up about 17% since 2019, 16 people die every day because compatible kidneys, livers, hearts, and lungs weren't found in time. On average, patients have to wait 2 years for a single lung and 3 to 5 years for a kidney, the most commonly needed transplant organ. Those delays stem from a shortage of usable organs, but also from mismanagement of the country's transplant system. In recent years, congressional committees have heard reports of organs being left to spoil in airports and arriving at hospitals in boxes marked by tire tracks. 1 in 4 kidneys removed from deceased patients never makes it to live ones. The National Organization in charge, the United Network for Organ Sharing, is 15 times more likely to lose or damage an organ in transit than an airline is of passengers' bags. An overhaul of the system was signed into law last year by President Biden, but for many, those reforms came too late. My dream is to have a healthy body, a working kidney, and a life that is mine, poet and lupus patient Tanya Ingram told Congress in 2021. She died 19 months later at age 31 after more than 3 years on the wait list. Why is the system so dysfunctional? Critics of UNOS say it's because the organization is a stagnant monopoly. Founded as a computer-based organ matching system in 1977, the private nonprofit won an exclusive government contract to manage the entire U.S. organ donation network in 1986. UNOS oversees 56 regional organ procurement organizations, or OPOs, which are responsible for collecting organs from hospitals and packaging and labeling them for delivery. UNOS has never revoked a single organization's license, even though regulators class a majority as failing or underperforming. A 2019 study found that OPOs could recover some 28,000 more organs from deceased donors every year. Accusations of financial mismanagement are also rife. A 2023 Health and Human Services report identified $664,295 in Medicare funds misspent by OPOs from 2015 to 2019, with money splashed on expensive meals, sports tickets, and other executive perks marked as education and awareness. The CEO of Los Angeles OPO, ranked among the worst in the nation, has an annual compensation package of about $1 million. Are there other problems? OPOs often use commercial ground couriers and airlines to transport organs, some of which end up lost in transit or get delayed beyond viability. In August 2019, one Dallas hospital announced it had lost 3 kidneys in just a month. One was delayed because of weather. Another was never placed on the intended flight. The third organ was mistakenly taken to the wrong airport and missed the intended flight. During transportation, many organs are tracked with phone calls and paper manifest. GPS and electronic tracking are not mandated. Despite the horror stories of lost and damaged organs, Roger Brown, a director of policy at UNOS, notes that almost all transplant tissue arrives at its destination without incident. "We're never going to get rid of flight delays," he told NBCNews.com. "We're never going to get rid of human error." How will the new law change UNOS? It breaks up the organization's federal contract and lets for-profit and non-profit groups bid for pieces. That competition and infusion of fresh expertise, lawmakers say, should result in improved oversight, technology, and logistics. But the problems with the national transplant system go beyond UNOS and OPOs, according to experts. The share of transplant kidneys discarded in the U.S. is double that of France or the U.K., partly because of how clinicians assess the organs. Surgeons typically only have 30 minutes to review donor and recipient characteristics before opting to approve or decline an organ, and many don't want to risk approving one with minor flaws. There's no penalty for a surgeon declining a kidney at the last minute, and no incentive to try to use a kidney that is found to have a repairable injury, said transplant surgeon Joshua Merzrich, or even a small area of discoloration. Decisions on a high-risk organ might also be affected by how much sleep a surgeon may have gotten, adds Merzrich, or how good a candidate the recipient is for the organ. How are potential recipients assessed? There are many variables, including a patient's age, overall health, and genetic makeup. Economic factors can also play a role. Panels at transplant centers judge candidates by the likelihood they will stick to a regimen of expensive drugs and whether they secured a full-time caregiver for their recovery. A 2023 study found that of the 44% of liver transplant candidates kept off the waiting list, 17% were denied because of lack of financial or social support. Among kidney patients, whites are 4 times as likely as blacks to receive a timely living kidney donation. Can new technology cut wait times? Biotech startups have started experimenting with animal organs, successfully implanting kidneys from genetically modified pigs into 2 patients too sick for the transplant list this spring. But such innovations are still in their early stage. For now, the focus remains on making the current system more effective. That alone could result in a zeroed-out waiting list for heart, lung, and liver transplants, and a sharply reduced wait for kidneys within 3 years, said Dr. Esther Chu, an emergency medicine expert at Oregon Health and Science University. Because the status quo is so dire, she added, it can only get better. And moving into a few of the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. Divestment is possible, but symbolic. Would divestment by universities do anything to halt the war in Gaza? Asked Annie Lowry. Students at campuses across the country are occupying university spaces in protest of Israel's war in Gaza, calling on their schools to divest their endowments from arms manufacturers and Israeli companies. Totaling nearly $1 trillion, university endowments are tangled webs of hedge funds, index funds, and private equity funds, so divestment wouldn't be straightforward or immediate. But it's certainly possible. Some schools have already divested from fossil fuel companies, private prisons, assault weapons retailers, and Russia. They also divested from apartheid South Africa after protests pressured them to do so in the 1980s. Schools would face little financial risk, heeding students' demands to divest from Israel, since their investments are spread across many industries. The firms being called out would experience similarly negligible financial consequences. Someone else would buy the school's stock shares. Divestment would achieve a purely symbolic goal. The students don't want their universities to be associated with the human tragedy in Gaza. But divestment won't bring down the Israeli economy or have any real impact on the war. A major obstacle to selling EVs. There is one thing holding the nation back from the dream of an all-electric future. Political polarization, said Shannon Osaka. A recent Gallup poll found that 61% of Democrats are opening to buying an electric vehicle in the future, while 69% of Republicans say they would not buy an EV ever. That huge disparity exists because GOP leaders, including Donald Trump, have injected electric vehicles into the culture wars, denouncing them as un-American and unmanly, a vehicle that only liberals would drive. After the Biden administration announced its plan to push car makers to rapidly ramp up electric car sales, Republican leaders started calling EVs Bidenmobiles and charged that Democrats are taking away Americans' right to choose which cars they drive. These complaints arise from a deep-seated psychological worldview that's hostile to change and new technology. As a result, EVs now sell mostly in Democratic areas. Cars have become not just a way to get around, but a form of personal expression, identity, and group membership. Unfortunately, once partisan buying trends start, they become calcified. If Republicans continue to disdain EVs, it will be almost impossible for the U.S. to meet its climate goals. This column comes from India. Wellness guru can't cure what ails us. India is finally cracking down on a famous quack healer, said Kaushik Das Gupta. For years, Guru Baba Ramdev has insisted there's no disease he can't cure with an herbal potion from his drug company, Patanjali. During the pandemic, Ramdev urged his millions of followers not to get vaccinated, claiming his tablets could cure COVID. Now the Baba's bluff has been called. In February, the Supreme Court ordered Ramdev to stop issuing misleading advertisements, and when he persisted, it held him in contempt. Now, Uttarakhand state, where Patanjali is based, is considering criminal charges. Yet, while Ramdev is the most influential charlatan, he is far from the only one. Indian social media is teeming with many Ramdevs, self-styled healers selling quick fixes for real ailments. As Indian diets and lifestyles have grown more modern and Western, the country is staring at an epidemic of non-communicable diseases, diabetes, heart ailments, blood pressure, obesity, even cancer. These can't be cured through herbs or tinctures, or even by appeals to Ayurveda, yoga, heritage, and tradition. What this country really needs is a meaningful debate on the food Indians eat and the lifestyles they lead, not wellness gurus who take people for a ride. And the last word, our feature article, titled this week, A Spiral of Rage. Joe Morelli made threats against Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene while in the grip of a mental health crisis, said Ruby Kramer in the Washington Post. Then came the consequences. The night he made the threat, Joe Morelli was exactly where he is now 2 years later, on his couch. The couch is blue and beginning to sag. It sits in the living room of his small apartment in Endicott, New York. Since Morelli, 52, also sleeps on the couch every night, he keeps a piece of plywood beneath the cushions because the softness of the cushions makes his back hurt. At the foot of the couch, he stores a few stacks of old family photos, including several of his two children, and he looks at the photos sometimes when he is feeling lonely, which is not all the time, but does happen, because he lives alone and has not spoken to his children in more than 20 years. When he wakes up on the couch each morning, he walks to the kitchen to make a pot of coffee, and then returns to the couch, where most everything else he needs is on the table in front of him. His pills, which he uses to treat his bipolar disorder, his gum, his glasses, his phone, and his remote, which he picks up now to turn on the television and watch the news, which is what he had been doing the night he got so angry that he made the threat. He opens YouTube on his smart TV. His usual channels appear on the screen, more of them left-leaning talk shows. Morelli's life since the threat has come with conditions mandated by a judge, including mental health treatment with a therapist who has asked him to write a list of behaviors to decrease. One is watching too much political news. Another is acting without taking a breath. Imagine that you are a small flake of stone, the therapist has told him. Imagine that you have been tossed out onto the lake and are now gently, slowly floating through the calm, clear blue water. He scrolls past a clip about a shooting in Kansas City. It began, he learns, when one group of strangers noticed another group of strangers looking at them funny and took it as a threat. How ridiculous, Morelli says. He goes to the kitchen for another cup of coffee, sits back down and scrolls through more clips. He clicks on one about demonstrators with Nazi flags in downtown Nashville. He clicks on another. In all the clips he watches, threatening behavior appears on the screen. There are threats every day now and no way to count them all. People who make threats online under screen names anonymously, publicly. They threaten friends, acquaintances, strangers, and they especially threaten the politicians they see on TV. At the federal, state, and local level, threats against elected officials have risen to record highs. In 2023, there were 8,008 recorded cases of threats against members of Congress, according to the U.S. Capitol Police. In 2022, there were 7,501 cases, and Morelli's threat was one of them. When he made the threat, it was by phone, and Morelli spelled his name for whoever might be listening on the other end. Joemorelli, he'd said from the couch. The threat had led to an FBI investigation, an arrest, a courtroom, a federal prison, and now back to the apartment in Endicott, New York, where Morelli has promised himself that he will not act without first taking a breath. He takes another sip of coffee. He pictures himself as the stone in the lake. He holds the remote and cues up the next video. That's how the threat had begun 2 years before, in between video clips. It was March 3rd, 2022, 8:30 p.m., when a campaign ad came on the screen showing Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene, the Republican from Georgia, lying on her stomach, her fingers wrapped around the trigger of a 50-caliber sniper rifle. "I'm going to blow away the Democrat socialist agenda," she said into the camera. She peered into the viewfinder at a Toyota Prius in an open field. On the side of the Prius, in large word, was the word socialism. Greene fired and the gun kicked back against her body. In the next shot, the car exploded, disappearing into orange flames. When the ad was over, Morelli had an idea. He was, at the time, in a mixed state of mania and depression. The depression meant that he had been shrinking away from the world, ignoring text even from his sister, who lived nearby and knew all about bipolar disorder, because she was a psychiatric nurse who treated bipolar patients all the time. The mania meant that, alone in the apartment, Morelli felt his mind racing. He walked to his computer and Googled the phone number for Greene's office on Capitol Hill. He dialed the number, and when no one answered, waited to leave a voicemail. It was 8:32 p.m. "Hi," he said. "My name is Joseph Morelli." He spelled his name. He gave his phone number. He said, "You should call the FBI field office in Binghamton, New York, and ask them how I deal with people who push hatred, influence hatred, and talk about how cool it is to own guns. Tell them my name, tell them I called you, and tell them I told you that I don't like you, and I would watch yourself with your effing hatred." 5 minutes later, at 8:37 p.m., he dialed the number a second time. "Hey, Joe Morelli again. You spread hatred, and you're going to pay for it. B." Same calm tone. He kept talking. "Man, you better hope I keep taking my medication." He laughed. "Keep blowing up Priuses." A few things Morelli hated about that ad. He had especially disliked Greene ever since he saw a video of her heckling a survivor of the Parkland, Florida school shooting outside the U.S. Capitol in 2019. He also hated guns, like the one she pointed at the word socialism. Then there were times when Morelli hated himself and his connection to that word because he relied on disability benefits, which he considered to be a form of socialism, one he believed in, but one that had been a source of some shame, too. Another thing Morelli knew about himself: "I can be vicious with my words." But nothing he'd ever said or done had amounted to a felony until that night on the couch, when, at 11:11 p.m., he picked up the phone and called Greene again. "I really think I'm going to have to cause you harm, physical harm," he said. "If you keep up with this hatred and people get hurt, I'm going to hurt you." "You promote violence," he said, calling again at 11:18 p.m. "I'm going to have to show you to your face, right up front, what violence truly is." He told Greene that even if he was in prison, he could pay two guys in Buffalo, where he had grown up, to take a baseball bat and crack your skull. It would cost him $500, he said. He hung up. 11:24 p.m. He picked up the phone again. "You're just causing hatred. You're going to cause people to get hurt. I'm going to have to hurt you physically." And again, Joe Morelli. M-O-R-E-L-L-I. 12:01 a.m., another call. "Hey, Joe Morelli again." 1:10 a.m., another call. "Yeah, I've just come to a decision. I can't have you out there inciting violence. You know, I'm going to have to stop you, just as simple as that." Then it was over. Seven voicemails in all. He fell asleep on the couch. When Morelli woke up the next morning, he tried to remember what he had done. He knew he had given his name, his phone number, the name of his town, and he had encouraged Green to call the FBI. He thought that if FBI agents were going to show up, it would be right away, but no one came. Oh, well, he thought. If he hadn't been manic, he might have been more worried, though it wasn't until later that he realized just how manic he had been. 8 days later, 8 days earlier, he had received electroconvulsive therapy, or ECT, to help pull him out of the depression. In the hospital, before the anesthesia took effect, he began grasping for his neck. He would remember later feeling like he couldn't breathe. He woke up in the recovery room afraid. He told his sister he didn't want to do ECT anymore. Now it was March 4th, 2022, and one of Green's aides, Travis Loudermilk, heard the voicemails and forwarded them to the U.S. Capitol Police, as he did with all the threats his boss received. The Capitol Police ran a search on the phone number associated with the calls, and what came back was a description for Joseph F. Morelli, white, bald, green eyes, 69 inches tall. On March 15th, a special agent at the FBI's Albany division requested an arrest warrant from a judge, and the next morning, at dawn, Morelli woke up to a bang outside his door. He thought his oven had exploded. He opened the front door and saw FBI agents and at least one armed law enforcement officer. He looked down and saw a red laser point on his chest. Outside the front of the house, two police cars blocked off each side of the street. He was cuffed, put in a car, and taken to an interrogation room where a video camera began to record the conversation. Across the table, two FBI agents told him he was being charged with making threats against Marjorie Taylor Greene. Morelli laughed. "What did I say?" "Well, it's funny you should ask," the first agent said. They began to play the voicemails. Soon after the interrogation, Morelli met his lawyer, a public defender named Gabrielle DiBella. When they listened to the voicemails together, Morelli told her he was surprised by how cold and level his voice sounded. He could understand, he said, how law enforcement, and probably also Green herself, might hear that voice and imagine a man who was serious about acting on his threat. He spent a few nights in jail and was released on house arrest. As the months went by and periods of depression came and went, he thought about what a trial would be like. In January 2023, he met with DiBella to make a final decision. She told him the jurors might lean politically conservative and that, if he testified, a prosecutor would try to provoke him into losing his temper. He decided to change his plea, and on February 1st, in a courtroom in Syracuse, he told a judge that he was guilty. 6 months later, Morelli received a sentence, 3 months in prison. 7 days after that, at a town hall in August, Green told a crowd about a man up in New York who had threatened her. He pled guilty. He didn't even deny it, she said, adding, "He's going to be met with a big wall of bullets if he comes to my house." On October 2nd, Morelli reported to a federal prison in New Jersey. He was in prison for 81 days. On one of those days, an inmate pulled him aside and told him there was someone he should meet. It was another prisoner, Patrick Stedman, who had just arrived and was serving 4 years because he was part of the insurrection on January 6th. He had been convicted of obstructing an official proceeding at the U.S. Capitol, where, according to the Department of Justice, he roamed the halls for more than 40 minutes, entered Nancy Pelosi's office, took photos of himself on the speaker's balcony, shouted, "Let us in," outside the House chamber, and later posted on social media, "The storm is here." "You should talk to him," the inmate told Morelli. "Two sides of the same coin." Morelli said okay, but as they introduced themselves to one another, here was the embodiment of all the people he'd seen on TV who had made him angry. But Stedman wasn't on TV. He was standing across from him, face to face. Morelli expected him to sound the way he imagined all Trump supporters, as a radical, hating everybody. And yet, the more they talked, the more Morelli liked him. He didn't seem hateful at all. He seemed smart. He had a business and a young family at home. He said he planned to spend his time in prison reading and detoxing from the news. And Morelli thought that was a good impulse, to get away from the anger that had surrounded them both. "I got caught up in the moment," Morelli remembers Stedman saying, and he understood how he felt. A version of this story was originally published in the Washington Post. Looks like we've got time for one of the Talking Points articles. We'll go with Florida, the new abortion battleground. Florida's strict new abortion law offers a grim preview of the future that pro-lifers want for women, said Maura Donegan in The Guardian. One of freedom being taken away. Under its former 15-week ban, Florida had been a refuge for abortion access in the South, where most states have near-total prohibitions on the procedure. More than 84,000 abortions were performed in Florida last year, including 9,000 for out-of-state patients. But as of last week, abortions are banned in Florida after 6 weeks of gestational age, before many women even know they're pregnant. Signed into law by Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, the ban contains some exceptions for rape, incest, or threats to life of the mother. But those vaguely worded clauses are moot if providers won't perform even medically necessary abortions out of fear of a possible felony conviction. The race to overturn the ban is now on, said Susan Del Percio in MSNBC.com. A proposed amendment to enshrine abortion access in the state constitution up to about 24 weeks of pregnancy will appear on the ballot in November. Since the fall of Roe v. Wade, abortion rights campaigners have won every referendum on the issue in both blue and red states, said Kimberly Leonard and Eric Sarkisian in Politico. But Florida is different. Ballot measures there need 60% voter support to pass, not just a simple majority. Reproductive rights groups fell short of that mark in red states, Kansas, 59%, and Ohio, 57%. Still, Democrats are campaigning forcefully for the ballot measure. President Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris have visited in recent weeks, hoping it could lift their chances in November and put a swing state that has trended ever redder into play. That's not going to happen, said Michael J. New in National Review. Two recent polls put support for the ballot amendment at 42% and 50%, meaning a pro-life victory is within reach. Those numbers will rise if voters understand that Florida's 6-week ban is not the end point, said Mary Ziegler in Slate. Already, anti-abortion leaders in the state are pushing for laws that would give fetuses and embryos the same legal protections as people, which would have implications not only for abortion, but also for IVF and perhaps common contraceptives. In November, Floridians won't just be deciding whether they approve of the new reality on the ground. They'll also be choosing whether to open the door to a campaign for much more sweeping fetal rights. And a few of the short notes. The November presidential election will likely be decided by about 6% of voters in 6 states, according to Republican and Democratic strategists. In 2020, Joe Biden's winning margin in those swing states, Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, amounted to just over 300,000 of the 158 million votes cast for president nationwide. 10 times as many seriously mentally ill people are being held in U.S. jails and prisons and are being treated as are being treated in hospitals. Experts estimate that about 200,000 to 300,000 prisoners have major psychological problems. A record 2,877 satellites were launched into orbit last year, a 15% increase over 2022. There are now 12,597 satellites in Earth's orbit. Experts warn that this unprecedented crowding raises the odds of collisions that generate clouds of space junk, potentially rendering parts of the planet's orbit unusable. In the 1960s, the 400 richest Americans paid about half their income in taxes. By 2018, their effective tax rate had fallen to 23%, lower than the rate paid by working class Americans. And we'll finish with a quote from Michael Jordan, quoted in the Chicago Sun-Times, who says, "I've failed over and over and over again in my life, and that is why I succeed." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call. The number is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.